there's a few things that I've learned that I wish I've known like a year ago, would have done faster. But to ask you a question, and I'm trying not to get too deep on this, right? But there's like two categories of things. There is, you know, classic business gaming advice stuff, right? Mm. Things to do, what not to do, technical things, decisions. And those are easy to teach to young entrepreneurs. But then there are the personal stuff, the character building stuff, the things that you learn as a CEO, the challenges, the ups and downs. And I just realized there's no way to teach this to people. Because I had the opportunity of mentoring a lot of young entrepreneurs. And I try to talk to them about these things. And it's very difficult for them to understand it. They haven't lived it. Some people call it like the rite of passage, right? You almost have to go through the difficult times to learn. And there's like no other way to...
Learning out of your own pocket.
Yeah.
Next level.
Next level on the ABXY podcast with Ziad, we have Karim Sadiq, the CEO and founder of Yalla Play. In this episode, we learn more about Karim's journey, why he started Yalla Play, where he started Yalla Play, his take on how to grow an ecosystem in the MENA region, as well as some advice for new entrepreneurs and VCs in gaming. Karim, welcome to the ABXY podcast with Ziad. I'm really happy to have you.
Likewise. Thank you for having me.
First, Karim, tell me more about... your journey. How did you get into gaming in the first place? Why did you choose the business of gaming? And what was the idea behind starting Yalla Play?
Absolutely. So that's the origin story. So I'll try to keep it short. But essentially, my background was in high technology. So I used to work at Dell Computers when I was doing architecture for companies like Facebook, Amazon, and Dropbox. Just building out their architectures and very focused on high scalability items. So I've always been in technology. And then we shifted and I started Yalla Play. Bit of a pivot in my career. It was initially an AI company. So we saw a problem in gaming in terms of AI for games, and we wanted to build a backend AI architecture for games that scales. So we're very focused on scalability component. So we built this AI for a game called Tarnib. So it was the era where DeepMind got acquired by Google, and they're doing really cool stuff and building very, very smart chess players. So we built a very smart, took us about 8 months to build this really smart AI player for Tarnib. And we launched on a website called Tarnib.com, and that got a lot of traction. We had over 200,000 users, it was growing. And at that point, we weren't really a company. We were just a cool, fun AI project. And we were very excited by our AI, but then we learned something a bit profound in the sense that it wasn't actually fun playing against a very smart AI player. So people were just losing left and right. This thing was defeating everyone. And only a small cohort of users were having fun playing as a smart AI. And we noticed that by making this AI intentionally lose, people had a bit more fun. And this is when the company was born, because we realized a fun AI is an AI that wins at the right time and loses at the right time. And the question was, what's the optimal, you know, win rate of an AI to create engagement? So that was Yalla Play back in the day when it first started.
So you told me it got acquired by Google?
No, DeepMind.
DeepMind was like, okay.
Yeah, no.
Okay, cool. So, and then like, it was a web game, right?
Yes. You told me we're on a website, 20.com, Flash-based. This is 8 years ago. So it was like back in the day.
Multiplayer, but you had AIs.
Yes, it was multiplayer. You can play with your friends or you can play against this AI we called Theta.
Okay.
And we actually sold Theta. So you get your credit card and you paid money and you could buy different levels of Theta. So we had like Theta Basic, and then I forgot the name, but like a super advanced Theta. That's like our best AI possible. And obviously only players who were, you know, very hardcore tourney players would actually purchase that $20 AI. But that was it. It was a very simple model back then. And again, we weren't a real company back then. But then we attracted VCs. Once we started thinking more about the gaming industry, and how our AI can be adopted and scaled, and how can we build AI not just for fun, but also tweaked for retention, later monetization. And we raised VC funding, and that's when I realized, okay, we have a company here. And we started in Austin, Texas. So that's where I used to live.
Okay.
Spent about 20-something years there. That's where I worked at Dell Computers at, and our team was all in Austin. And then I met the CTO, and we expanded to Brazil, because he is Brazilian.
Yeah, cool. So step back. How did you come up with the idea to develop the AI for Tarnib? Like, why did you, like, you at the time went at Dell?
Yeah. Dell,
and
okay.
What happened?
That's a good question. So, I mean, very simply, I met a few friends. And we used to play Tarnib all the time.
Ah, okay. And in the US.
In the US. And I'd like to think I'm a good player, but I sucked at Tarnib. And I found out that the reason I sucked at the game was just because of memory. And I needed a little helper. So I literally wrote a little macro tool that would bring with me to these games, and I would like input the data, and then like it would be kind of an aid to play Tarnib. Everyone called it cheating, but that's kind of how the thing started, and then that evolved into a true player. And one important thing about the website, our goal back then was to develop AI, so we need a lot of training data. So that website served as a portal for training data, and we had like over a million Tarnib games clocked on that website. So that's what allowed us to build this model. And then that was really very early on, like before, we weren't even called Yalla Play back then. So it was a different name, Tarnib, Ultimate Tarnib or something like that. So
the company, you mean?
The project.
The project.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. And then you attracted VC funding from the US, I guess?
We met them in the US, but we actually raised from the region. So our very first seed investment was from the region.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very exciting for us. In a way, it was a double-edged sword. We were based in Austin, but we raised from the region. So, and it was an interesting proposition because the region was still very, very young. So there was no such thing as gaming in the region. So I'm talking about, UAE, Lebanon, especially Saudi. It didn't exist. We were very, very early in that stage. But again, we didn't market ourselves as a gaming company. We marketed ourselves as an AI play serving gaming industry.
So the game was a tool for you to actually...
The game was a tool.
Yeah.
The game was a tool.
And you told me your CTO was based in Brazil.
Yep.
So I guess from day one, you were like a remote company, like you operated in a remote way.
CTO joined us a couple of years later.
Oh, okay.
So we were in Austin, 100%. And then we expanded to Brazil. And then most of the development naturally shifted to Brazil because US is super expensive.
Yeah.
Except for core architecture, initially it was in the US. And then game development was happening mostly in Brazil. And then we started expanding internationally because we realized, at least in the gaming space, you're always trying to attract the best talent regardless of where they're sitting. So we had that luxury and we started, expanding internationally. And then COVID hits and then we realized, oh, great, we're not affected because everyone's all over the place anyways. But we always built this company from the grounds up to be operating extremely efficiently, whether remote or local. So the way we're set up, we were using Slack, our online systems, our tools, our documentation. Everything was really built as a proper engineer organization where you can operate in silos. And whether those silos are local or they're abroad, it worked out well.
Okay, and you attracted this VC funding. What was the purpose of that? So why did you raise, like, to build on the momentum, to build new games? What was the point of raising at the time?
Yeah, VC funding was to shift to mobile. We were a website, and monetizing a website back then was very difficult, and we weren't depending on ad revenue. So it was essentially build mobile, and most importantly, continue building out our backend architecture, because the company's IP is all in this backend architecture. It's all in this monetization, AI-driven backend multiplayer engine.
Cool. By the way, how did you used to monetize on the web? Like, was it ads also?
No, credit cards, literally credit card, and you pay $20 to buy.
Oh, it was a premium game.
It was a premium game. Okay. No, the game was free. But if you wanted to purchase the smart AI, you had to pay. Yep.
Interesting. Okay, cool. And at the time, you're telling me that you actually raised from the region, which is interesting. You were early, like gaming there was presence, but it wasn't as it is today. What were the challenges that you faced at the time?
I think our biggest challenges was just fundraising initially. So every time we have to go fundraise, and we've raised 3 rounds. So every time I had to go fundraising, I felt that I had to kind of explain what gaming is.
Yeah.
Right. So
it's my case as well.
I literally had a pitch, my pitch deck. I don't know why I thought that the closest resemblance of a gaming model was SaaS models. So my pitch deck was like a SaaS pitch deck. I was talking about CAC and LTV, and I mean, the ratios were completely off, but that was my pitch deck. And it worked because we were able to raise funding. And we were lucky because we always had traction. So we had that in our favor. Mm-hmm. but the model and the evaluations and the revenues and Kareem, how does that even work? That was the first challenge. The second challenge is the stigma around gaming being a very hit-driven business.
Yeah.
Which is true, right? It's a hit-driven business, which means some
to
games
make... To
a certain
extent, that's true.
Yeah.
It's not like the movie business.
Exactly.
We have that there's some data that we base our decisions on that we can... like we can improve on our games through that data. It's live data, like as opposed to like for the film industry, for example.
100%. You're absolutely right. So it looks like we face the same challenges. So I also had to really sell the fact that we're not a hit-driven business. We are going after, you know, solid game loops, existing communities, existing users. We're not reinventing the wheel here. We're not trying to build the next Angry Birds. And that was the other thing. It was a very... All the eyes were on the unicorn games, like your Angry Birds, your Candy Crush. And then they would say, Kareem, so what guarantees do you have that you're going to build the next Candy Crush? I was like, I'm not trying to build the next Candy Crush. So, but yeah, that's bringing a lot of nostalgia because now the industry is a lot different. So.
But has fundraising changed for you? I mean, at the time you told me like fundraising was one of the biggest challenges.
Yep.
Is it still the case today or is it like it has become easier or is there less educating to do with the investors? How do you see this?
I think our story changed the most. So now we're a lot bigger of a company than we were before. So now our shift in the fundraising cycle is away from seed. It's more towards like PE, actually.
Mm.
But so that's different. And that lends itself to you talking to more international players than local players. But when I do speak to local gaming VCs, or like local VCs, there aren't that many gaming VCs, probably one or two I can mention. When I speak to local VCs, yes, the challenge is still there. I have to
educate.
Exactly. I have to, like, you know, pitch deck V2.
I actually have two pitch decks.
Pitch deck for you local.
VCs. Yeah.
Which is honestly, I enjoy doing. I honestly enjoy, because again, VCs are extremely intelligent and wise in how they make the investment decisions. I mean, that's their job. So my job is to convert our company into a model that they can understand. And in their ratios and their risk appetite, because they need to be able to gauge the risk appetite, right? So that's, I enjoy doing this, so I don't mind this fact. And there's something cool also about educating a VC. All right, guys, let me tell you how to make money. But yeah, I think it does make it a bit difficult. And I feel that when we travel to London or Turkey or the US.
Definitely.
And I do there. Yeah.
Yeah.
I almost have to like, okay, don't insult these guys.
V1, go back
to V1.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, so that's something we have to, maybe an extra hat that we have to wear when you're fundraising here.
Cool. So you worked on the Turnip game, and then you raised around. By the way, I'm curious about why. I mean, if it was your intention in the first place, but were you able to raise from the US or from Latin America, for example, if your team was based in Brazil, or like was it not on your agenda in the first place? Why did you choose the region, or why were you able to raise from the region as opposed to the others? I'm trying to understand the difference in the ecosystems in gaming as well as in like normal traditional VCs. I mean,
that's a great question, and unfortunately, the answer isn't very sophisticated. It's how it happened. So in the region, I mean, I have connections with the region. My family's been here. My parents were here. So on a visit here, approached some VCs, and we got connected to them in the US anyway. So it just worked out that way. And number two, we had this game called Tarnib, which is a Middle Eastern game, even though we're based in the US, and that got really popular. I mean, we had 500,000 fans on Facebook, had a big brand around it.
Sorry, where's your user base?
So back then, it was the Middle East. Tarnib game.
Okay,
exactly. So we had a lot of, let's call it, branding equity here, even though the tech was built out of the US. And we were asked to be on TV, and there was a lot of things that we did. So it had a big name here. So I think that helped it was very simple back then to tell people who we are here. Mm-hmm. Right? The challenge was the business model.
Yeah,
but there wasn't much
educating to do to the users. Like the game was known actually.
Exactly.
In the region. Yeah, I got it.
We were the largest, you know, 4-player card game back then on mobile.
Cool. You also mentioned that. So you, now, I mean, at the time, your user base was in the Middle East. What about now? Like, how is it different?
It's all over the world, but majority is in the US.
What happened?
Ironically, I know where you're going to go with this because, like, I know. And now we're shifting. Now we've moved the company to the UAE, and then now the majority of the users in the US. Nothing happened. I mean, we still have entity in the US, entity in Brazil, and entity here. So I like to say we're just kind of trying to get the best of both worlds, and also from a tax structure, operational structure, collecting revenue here is more advantageous.
Yeah. But the users are in the US. But what happened? I mean, at the time, there wasn't...
We still have Brazil. So most of the problems in Brazil as well. Being here also allowed us to tap all into the European market. So some advantages as well. And there's a lot of talent right above us in Europe within the two-hour time zone of our work.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. From here, from the UAE.
From the UAE.
Yeah, definitely. But the question is, so why did your user base shift... Like at the time you had to do...
We have multiple games. No, we still have a massive user base in the Middle East, sorry. We launched a new game, Spades Masters, and that's user base in the US. Mm-hmm. So our company is not one game only. Again, we have our own engine and we're deploying multiple games on it. And we have another game coming out that's going to be global. We have another game in the pipeline, also global. And then we have another game, more Canada. So each game has its own predetermined territory where we think it's going to be popular.
Okay, so you're catering for different audiences,
exactly.
Different demographics.
Exactly.
Okay, cool. You mentioned that whenever you go to Turkey, to London, to these events, there's a shift that happens in your head in terms of what you'd be pitching. I'm interested to learn or to hear from you what are the differences in these markets, like as opposed to Turkey and to London and to like Europe in general.
Yeah.
How do we compare, in your opinion, I mean, in the region, how do we compare as gaming businesses? And do we even compete?
Listen, okay, there's advantage and disadvantages, to be honest. There is an advantage of being here, right? You get the advantages of emerging markets, basically, when it comes to gaming. So there's a lot more, less competition, 100% for sure. VCs or investors willing to get into gaming, specifically focus on international plays, here being international. This is a perfect opportunity for you to be in front of them here. When you're fundraising back in the US, it's way more difficult. All your ratios, your metrics, your cost structures, your models, everything's a bit off than what you're used to. Ticket prices are just way higher there, which is another maybe not a Middle East issue, maybe it's a global gaming thing, but you can find two studios building similar games with 5x difference in production costs. And you wonder what's going on. So being here is interesting because it kind of removes all that. But at the same time, when it comes back to your question about, I don't think one is easier or more difficult. There's cons and pros in all honesty. However, there's way more supply of investors and VCs in Europe and in the US, way more, right? So you're able to go out there and essentially sell your story a lot quicker and find a perfect fit or a good fit investor a lot faster. As long as, of course, you have all your metrics, you have your... Because see, VCs, that's one thing. And then VCs over there know what they're looking for.
They're focused on gaming.
They're focused on gaming. And not even gaming. Within gaming, the market is segmented into like, you know, early stage, late stage, portfolio plays, whatnot. So they know what they want, even down to the genre, right? For example, some VCs are publishers only, right? Well, I don't think investment problems, but let's say specific type of developers, specific genre, some are, tech plays or infrastructure plays in gaming. So it's like a very focused thing. And if you check their boxes, you have a foot in the door. Here, VCs are a bit more general gaming. So now they're looking at console, they're looking at mobile, they're looking at a couple of different genres, they're looking at multiplayer, single player, and that I think makes it hard for them to have conviction once you pitch your story to them, because it's always going to be a new story.
Interesting. I'm happy you mentioned publishers because actually I was having a conversation a couple of days ago with a friend of mine about the difference between like normal startups and gaming startups in general.
Yeah.
And it was hard for me to explain or to find the alternative of a publisher in the startup world. Like,
yeah,
you mentioned a publisher could be an investor but might not be an investor at the same time. what is a publisher like for those who are watching from not from the gaming industry? What could be compared to a publisher in the normal world, like in the tech ecosystem?
So I think it's important to answer that question in different silos. So platform specific, right? So a mobile game publisher is a little bit different than your console publisher, a little bit different than your PC publisher. I'd like to say maybe, again, I don't have that much experience in console and PC, but I'd like to feel that they're more similar than a mobile game publisher. So mobile game publisher is very different. And I think it's because, you know, a publisher's main role is to publish, which is basically mean to grow and scale your game. They invest marketing dollars or resources to grow your game. Now, I feel that the user acquisition story in mobile is extremely different than it is in PC on console. Yeah. So that lends their operations, even their finances and the way they evaluate projects is extremely different. In mobile specifically, at the end of the day, they're looking at your cost per install, your CPI, and then your LTV, and essentially a return on ad spend from their spend. So they know, I'm going to spend a dollar, I'm going to make $2. And they want to see that equation. And then they factor in scalability in your team and marketability, a lot of different things. So that's your mobile publisher. So
they're essentially a marketing agency in the game space.
Yeah, I don't want to say the word marketing agency, but yes, right? They're spending the dollars and they're taking a revenue share at some point. Now, where they start working with you in the development cycle is what sets them apart. So some publishers, like on the hyper-casual part, will only invest their money after they have proven the metrics. So you build your game, you give it to them, they test it, they look at the numbers, and they make a decision, we will invest or not invest. And then you have, those are hyper-casual games, but then you have some games like mid-core games or higher production value games. Those cost a lot of money to go build out. So some of these publishers might come in a bit earlier in the conceptualization phase of the game, or maybe even the prototype phase of the game. They can, I mean, every publisher is very different.
No.
And then they partner up with you if they believe in the team, they believe in the market, and they believe you're going to do something well. And they support you, and they actually give you a budget for development. So every publisher is different, and it also depends on the time. So over the past 5 years, the market really shifted, you know, from IAP monetization to ads monetization. Now we're going back to IAP monetization. You know, premium model back in the day, free to play forever. Now we're still free to play, but the mix is a bit different. So also depending on the timing, the publisher's role also has to adapt to those markets. And I think also there is a movement into self-publishing. And I don't have data to back this up, but I start recognizing smaller studios saying, heck, you know, let's just raise our own little funding and then do what publishers are doing themselves, because the tools and the automation and the data is now all there. I can do everything myself. So without getting into too much details, I hope that answers the question. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe like I mentioned that the publisher is like a marketing agency and in the traditional, not traditional, but like in the tech ecosystem, but that marketing agency actually shares the revenues with you. So this is, I think this is the closest to the closest thing to a publisher that we have in the normal world. So we talked about publishers, their role, how important they are. We've discussed also VCs,
yep,
like investors, their role and how important they are. Now, what about talent? I mean, if we compare to the other regions, mm-hmm, in terms of talent, I know you mentioned that we're 2 hours away from talent across the region. How do we compare in the region in terms of talent with Europe, let's say, or the US, or even South America, or even Southeast Asia, in your opinion?
So naturally, we're a bit, I don't say the word behind, but we are a smaller community.
Mm.
So educational programs, access to training, etc., still a bit in the early stage of ecosystem building, if you will. So yes, in terms of, if you're a company trying to hire people, you're going to struggle to hire from here, right? And not only this, most of the talent that is going to be here are actually going to be younger, more junior side of the scale. Mm. If you're looking for like serious talent who are like 20 years under their belt, 15 years under their belt, obviously you're not going to find them here. So as a company starts growing, starting from an idea to professional studio, you're going to find yourself 100% hiring from abroad and moving them here.
To scale or to grow as a company?
To scale as a, grow as a company.
But is it the quality of the talent, or is it like the experience of the talent?
I don't think it's the quality. I think the quality is very high here.
Yeah.
I think it's just the experience. And that's a great question. I'm glad you corrected me on this. No, the quality is high. It's just the experience. You're going to find yourself, at some point, I was telling my team, I'm like, guys, I feel like we're running a university. Because we hire this very fresh young graduates, and then we're like teaching them all these things. And part of me is like, I'm a gaming company. I'm already super high risk. Why am I doing this stuff like the big guys like Ubisoft should be doing? Hey, go work at Ubisoft for 10 years.
Super dynamic environment. Yeah, when you're having these guys. But this is how you grow like a company in a region where there's a small community of developers, and then there's not much experience under their belt. So I'm happy that we touched on the talent, on the publishers, and on the VCs.
Yeah.
What do you think we lack in the region in order to become like a global powerhouse or a development hub as the countries here are aiming to be?
Yeah. It's a very open-ended question.
Yeah, I'm trying to understand your perspective on this. I have my own.
Yeah. I would love to hear your thoughts. However, if we're speaking government support as a big umbrella, I think if you look at historically, almost every region that has a profound gaming community, if you go back in history, there was some government involvement program at some point to accelerate this, or some interests at the government level, right? Because you have to create, you have to lay the groundwork. You have to bring in the educational programs. Schools have to be interested. Nobody wants to take the risk. So you'd like an entity such as a government to step in, cover that risk. So I think governments here are doing a great job in trying to enter that. So they're doing the right steps. Can they push a bit further? Of course. But so that's a good thing. And I think lots of this has to happen and continue to happen until the ecosystem reaches like a tipping point, if you will, where it can self-sustain itself. Because right now you're in this situation where you have talent coming in, but then you have attrition and they leave, coming in and they leave. So you're almost like this network effect where you have to continue growing your ecosystem until it becomes self-sustainable. You have a couple of unicorn companies here, a couple of like larger companies, such as like Peak Games out of Turkey, right? Just created the whole...
This is my question.
Yeah.
How to get a unicorn company from the region? How can we achieve that?
I mean, I have my own ideas on how to do that. You know, I'd like to say that we could one day become a unicorn company, but I think it's, and I speak a lot to government officials about this, but at the end of the day, you have to balance the battlefield. You have to level the playing field in terms of us here versus Europe versus the US or whatever region you want to pick. It can't be more difficult to me to operate a gaming studio here than it is to operate it in Europe. I'm using the word Europe just...
Is it more difficult?
It still is. It's a lot easier than it was, let's say, 3 years ago, but it's still more difficult. There's a lot of challenges. And by just adding this friction, I mean, gaming companies are already ultra risk. So you want to de-risk it as much as possible, support it as much as possible. I'm not just saying financially, but just in as all aspects as possible that the government can do. And then that is, I think that's the minimum to like level the playing field. So now I'm not just competing with a studio out of, you know, anywhere in Europe and having to worry about all these other things you're not worried about. So I think once that's fixed, now we can start building companies here.
Can you give me an example of these things that you worry about that I'm genuinely interested to know? Like, you're telling me it's still harder. It's easier than it used to be, but it's still harder than to operate a studio here than in Europe.
Yeah.
What's harder?
Yeah. So there's a lot of different things. I've crossed all different things. I mean, a simple one would be, let's say, raising debt. Right. Let's say I want to go raise debt. I'm in a stage of the company where I can take on some debt, help scale my games. You will not find anyone here to raise debt.
Definitely.
Number one. Number two, if you do find someone in Europe or in the US and raise debt, they're not going to be able to look at your financials or your banks over here. They don't understand, you know, the operating system here, like your financial statements here and whatnot. They'll tell you, hey, we work with US entities. Only or these entities, actually most of the ones I've spoken to. So luckily we have a US entity, so we use that to do all the legal contracts and agreements. And this is just, I guess, on the business side of things, small
structure.
Exactly. On operational side of things, tools and talents and everything just a bit more difficult. experience is a bit more difficult, access to resources is a bit more difficult. So there's just this friction like everywhere you go, right? Heck, moving money in and out of banking, like we're dealing with the dirham here and then you want to like transfer money out. You have to deal with our own licensing and things here. There was no gaming license 4 years ago. So you're trying to do transactions. There's no check. So very small items like this, you're just pioneering everything and you're going through a lot of what I call teething problems being the first here. And, you know, I could sit down and write you a very long list of things. None of them are showstoppers, right? None of them will stop you from starting your business. But I'm just dealing with this unnecessary burden.
And they pile up at some point.
And they start piling up. And you're like, what am I doing? I'm trying to build a game here, not worry about legals and contracts and finances and all these things. So, so I think that's something to keep in mind as well.
Interesting.
Even the big players, right? When you think of, and of course that problem is now fixed, but if you think of, there was a time back in the day where people were creating US entities to be able to work with Apple and upload their game. Because if you create like a local entity, there's no, it's not in the drop-down menu, right? There's no UE in the drop-down menu for Apple. Obviously that completely changed. I'm talking about like 8-9 years ago, but I remember when we first started, we're like, okay, I'm glad we're in the US. So those are examples of like infrastructure plays, infrastructure things that make it a bit challenging in the region.
I feel that the infrastructure today is actually good here in the UAE.
Mm-hmm.
But in my opinion, what we, like the way I see things is, in order to get to have that unicorn, you have to publish games.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we struggle to do here is to actually raise money, you raise debt, raise UA money, raise funding, like normal funding, in order to push your games.
Yeah.
So instead we rely on publishers to push our games.
Yep.
Hence we will never, I mean, that's a bit dramatic, but we won't be able to publish ourselves. So we wouldn't be getting a unicorn. This is one of the things that I see. In terms of infra, I think we're in a good place. We're not like, we're getting there. We're getting there. This is why I was trying to get there to see if you see the same not issue but like the same perspective, like if you have the same perspective as me, since you mentioned Peak Games. What happened after Peak Games?
Let me go back to my Turkish history.
Yeah.
So I don't know all the details, but I remember Peak got acquired, at least their card gaming division got acquired, and they built their other game, which is a massive success. And then a lot of employees, I mean, they grew, had a lot of people, educated them. A lot of those guys ended up starting their own studios, building out talent. It was kind of the, you know, the spark that started the gaming fire, if you will, in the region. And I always believe you need that. I mean, we had that here in Dubai, in the UAE, with Uber's acquisition of Careem.
Yeah.
Right,
but not in gaming.
Not a gaming company, right? Outside of gaming, and you see that spurred a lot of founders, a lot of different companies that brought in a lot of VCs. A lot of those, I know them, some of them personally, started VCs or started working at the prominent VCs here. But again, not gaming, but you need that catalyst to help grow local.
Which is a publisher.
The good thing is, I know you mentioned publishers, but the truth is, a lot of gaming companies don't need publishers to grow. It depends on what you're doing, right? So
and you can self-publish.
You can self-publish.
That's the point.
I can self-publish or get your own funding, or heck, you could get lucky where a game just bootstraps itself to the millions. But you're absolutely right. So that catalyst is what we're missing. I think we need a little bit more of those. And then to accelerate this catalyst, we need either VCs to take more risks. All right, guys, if part of your mandate is invest locally, you want to go into gaming, you want to be in the early ones, you know, just be willing to take a bit more risk and just invest in the talent here. Other thing is government support, right? Grow this out. But I agree with you 100%. The thing that's interesting is you can have a company here and still fundraise internationally. Like nothing stops you from doing that.
Yeah, but having access to these, to the VCs or to, like publishers, you have access to them, but VCs in general, they tend to invest more locally. I mean, not everyone.
In the ecosystem they're familiar with.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yep. So when you go and tell them, hey, we're this company out of the UAE, they're like, okay, cool. It's a bit more difficult of a sell. Like,
yeah. Now we're getting some attention in the region. So maybe in the near future, we would be able to actually raise from, I mean, people raised from international VCs, but I mean, this could be could become better.
Yep.
But to go back on the catalyst, I know I asked the question before, but to get that catalyst, and we're not looking for shortcuts, what do you think should we be doing here in the region in order to achieve like a catalyst that can actually pop up many companies like Rolik did actually in Turkey?
Yep.
And if you go back to Finland, for example, if you're talking about Finland, you can go back to Angry Birds, to Supercell, and to these yep. companies. So what does it take? Or what do we need today? How can we get there in like 2 years, like 3 years maybe? We have many companies here. And these companies, they've actually, like today we have some experience, at least like we have 8, 9 years, 10 years of experience. Some have more. I mean, this is enough in terms of experience to do something different. What do you think should be done in the next, like, let's say, a couple of years?
So first, I need to mention there are some very strong programs here. So, for example, AD Gaming is thinking on that level that I mentioned earlier. So they have an amazing gaming program for companies to set up here, and they support them with subsidies, you know, amazing facilities. And those are like kind of like the direct benefits, and some of the indirect benefits of the ecosystem building. So a lot of these events that mm-hmm. started appearing here, one could argue they're connected by, you know, AD Gaming's marketing and really trying to set itself, you know, Abu Dhabi as, you know, a leader in gaming in the region. And of course, because of those efforts, Dubai is now, you know, closely monitoring and also going to be setting up as well, try their own programs. So one thing's leading to another. It's kind of like a domino effect, but someone had to take the lead. And this is kind of going back to that catalyst, like someone has to push that first domino and everyone will follow. So, and I think companies can do the same thing. So I have a bit of a bias of really wanting Yalla Play to be gaming unicorn in the region, right? And maybe I have a personal yeah. agenda, right? Because I was born and raised here, even though I spent most of my life in the US. So I kind of have that. So I fit in that category of, okay, I'm very focused on creating value for shareholders. Definitely want to find the best solution to increase this value. But at the back of my mind, I also want to support the region as much as we can. And this is why when we're hiring, we're okay to take on some juniors. We're okay to be training people. We're okay doing these things because it fits in our mandate as a company. And not every mandate has to be, you know, value, financial, Wall Street driven. So so I think if more companies do what we're doing, small companies, medium-sized companies, larger companies, and if everyone just start thinking of, hey, I'm not just here to grow my company. And if you will, just really be dependent on government support. But I'm actually really here to support the ecosystem as well. And we all collectively support each other in that regards. Because, you know, we're not really competing. I think the collective together, we can, you know, create something. I really do. Because we have that benefit of, I call it like the minority benefits, right? So we want to stick together. We want to do something together. And, you know, let's say company A is working on a product. Company B works on a product. Company A doesn't work out. Guess what? And company B successful.
Can hire
the A, exactly. Right? Come together, guys. Let's do this. And I see this happening. I mean,
yeah.
Most of our hires were from other companies. Most of our hires are from abroad. But I think it's that, you know, sticking together and just realizing that our mission is to grow our companies, but we should also support each other and just growing this ecosystem. And we have to admit, we all have a personal bias for being here as well, right? At the end of the day, as a founder and CEO of a company, I mean, part of your decision-making of where you want to settle is, yeah, where it makes more sense for the business, but also there's a personal reason of why you live where you live, right?
Yeah.
Otherwise, all of us would live in Eastern Europe and build games there, right? So that's something to keep in mind. And I think that's a benefit that sometimes founders underestimate the power of.
Yeah.
The collective.
Now we have lots of attention on the region,
mm-hmm.
especially you mentioned AD Gaming and the Dubai program, and now we have also programs in Saudi Arabia. Also, Jordan had a couple of, actually more than one success.
Yep.
What would you say to those companies, those publishers, those VCs that are watching us from abroad? Where do we stand today as a region? And like for them, if they're interested to come here, they like that. They want some some insights. Where do we stand in terms of as an ecosystem today, and where would you position us?
Region compared to the world, or UAE come within the region?
I think the region as a whole, because yeah. We have many countries actually working on different programs, yeah. And we've had successes before. We yeah. had acquisitions as well, but they were, for some reason, they were not catalysts. So where do we stand?
Listen, I think it's not really about where we stand. I mean, it depends on which metric you're looking at, right?
I mean, for
those, like, number of successful companies, still not the top of the list, right? I mean, so in terms of companies, I wouldn't think so. In terms of investments happening, so it depends on which KPI we're looking at for me to build this leaderboard, if you will.
I think people abroad are interested in investment.
So in that context, there is a golden opportunity of investing here, because you're kind of just in any classic investment, you're buying in low, right?
Yeah.
So your upside, maybe your beta, your risk is a bit higher, but you're still buying in low when you come here. Mm. And by doing this, if you hit the right investments, then you can really make gains. That's one aspect of it. But the second aspect, and more concrete sort of points, is that the consumers here spend a lot per capita on gaming. If you think about like Saudi, GCC countries,
yeah, definitely.
Actually a lot more than other like tier one countries, US or whatnot. So that's another opportunity to actually create. I'm talking about creating games.
And CPMs are cheaper.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right? For the local market. There's that argument. One could argue the market size is a bit smaller, but the spending, the ARPU, average revenue per user, is a lot higher here than abroad. So there's that other angle to it. But then last but not least, there is the, you know, less competition between the studios here, that golden opportunity. So, and again, a lot of VCs, I don't work for a VC myself, but a lot of VCs are interested only in international plays. So a lot of VCs I spoke to from New York saying, we want to invest in the region. And they have the reasons for that, some opportunities here. So I think it's, at the end of the day, very interesting for a VC from abroad to come here. Even more interesting for a local VC to invest in gaming.
Definitely.
And catch it very, very early. And I mean, most important for a local VC as well is, like, we're going to be speaking their same language, right? Same language, same culture, if that's something they care about. But I think there's some profound benefits of having that as well.
Well, you mentioned local players and the ARPUs are higher than the rest of the world. We've seen, like, for example, Jordan is a place where the studios are mostly focused on local players.
Yeah.
We've seen some acquisitions happening there. We've seen some successes. But if you take a look at the market today, it feels a bit stagnant in terms of growth, in terms of like of player user base growth, in terms of other games actually penetrating the market. So for example, if like, who doesn't play Call of Duty, for example?
Yeah.
Why would I recreate something localized? Do you think there's still value in investing in games that are not hyper-localized, but I mean like catered for the region?
So the short answer, I have my personal opinion on this. Okay. So some of the success that happened recently were just due to blue ocean effect, yeah. Right? So Joaquin are very, very successful, but they had like zero competition. You know, they're out there building every single local card game possible or board game possible. So they commanded the entire
market. We have some card games. What Jawaker did is actually package them
together.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's an example of like, they're not really competing on a global, that's not Call of Duty. They're not competing on a global scale. It's just like a very hyper
Candy Crush.
Yep. So Candy Crush. So I personally don't believe, unless you're really targeting a very cultural local game, I don't believe in the model of building just for the region.
Yeah, okay.
Right? I mean, the region is too small.
I'm happy we agree on that.
Yeah, yeah. And I think most people do agree on this. Now, I understand that as a smaller studio, right, if you're not trying to build the next Call of Duty, I mean, Saudi is a huge market and you can build a formidable business building a game for the region. And it probably makes sense if I'm a smaller studio and I'm trying to create a,
you know,
six-digit valuation company.
Could be a stepping stone for you to like to
yeah. Or seven digits, like a small success story that it makes total sense. That's my first go-to, right? So in that context, I think it's completely fine. So I'm building this game. I want to have, you know, 200,000 users maximum.
Yeah.
I'm going to make some revenue, sustain a studio. I'm happy with it. It's my first entry to the market, and that's fine. But when you're a massive entity and you're trying to build the next global hit, it's not going to work. So it depends on, you know, what your goals are. And I can argue that building a local game is a way easier operation and a way lower risk, even though the upside is completely capped, than trying to go after the next, you know, world hit wonder.
Way more risk?
Locally? No, less risk.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
A lot less risk, right?
Definitely.
But obviously a lower upside as well. Are you thinking of building a local game?
Not really, but because I've heard of programs that are actually focused on building local games.
I mean, Tornee was a local game. And for us, we specifically built it as an MVP for our engine. And it exploded.
Yeah.
We built a good product. There was nothing else like it. And it just grew. And for us, acquiring...
Tornee was a card game at the end of the day.
It was a card game.
Yeah.
I mean, so that's a very local... We didn't invent something new. So it's a card game. It's for the region. Heck, it was in Arabic. So...
Let us not consider card games.
Mm-hmm.
The other types of games, how would you localize them other than the like art and some translocalization, like whatever? But I mean, this is where I feel that people are getting it wrong, in my opinion, because I've heard a lot of studios, a lot of initiatives that are trying to invest in studios that are building local games, and this is something that I always try to talk to them and tell them, guys, it's not about this. I mean, I've had discussions before, and one of my guests' opinions that you'll listen to in next episodes, he says that in his opinion, the only market that is worth localizing for is China, because it operates in a different way.
I can already guess to the guest.
Yeah. But for us as an Arab, as a MENA region in general, you can adopt any game. Like you rarely find a game that is focused on a certain market or on a certain region. You know, you might find them, but as you said, they're like for the early stage companies. And then if you want to grow your company, you have to target globally. Why are we still focusing on local games in the region? And this is only my question, not to you, but I mean, I'm wondering myself.
Yeah, I mean, I'm on your side on this one. It really depends on your agenda here. There's a market locally, obviously, but in my opinion, the upside is always going to be capped. But one can argue it's way easier to market locally. I remember when we had 500,000 fans on Tornee, and it was all organic. Mm-hmm. I'm like, wow, this is super simple. Create a cool game, a couple of people talk about it, it just spreads. I find it hard to get that level of success.
Definitely.
Unless you have like a super interesting one-hit wonder, especially today. Right? I mean, there's like billions of games on the App Store. So I agree with you. But again, remember, I think it's good to put in context, you know, who you're talking to. A smaller studio, honestly, I would advise, hey, start locally, build something. But you asked something earlier, which is the thing about building local games is actually a bit tricky. Most of the local games end up looking like Aladdin for some reason.
Yeah.
Called like the Aladdin effect. It's like, okay, how do we make this super cliche? You know, make everyone wear like how to make it like super Middle Eastern. And I'm like, why? I don't think that's what people do, right? So I have to admit it's a cultural thing. It's a bit difficult sometimes. But if you nail it just right, you know, your market is limited.
It's a marketing gimmick.
It is. It's a marketing gimmick. Again, I met a few very talented studios when on my trip to Saudi. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to lie, they built some really cool local games. Like, I'm having a different...
Yeah, I've seen.
...fun. There's a game called Ozuma.
Yeah.
So the idea is so cute. Like, I'm like, wow, this is hilarious. Like, you're this guy who gets invited to his family house. You don't want to be there. So you're trying to avoid all your aunts and uncles because, you know, when you get invited to these massive family gatherings... You don't want to like small talk with everyone there. So your mission is like to avoid the family. So it's a cool story. And I feel like other cultures may not be able to, maybe some cultures, you know, resonate with this, but I'm like, this is hilarious. And all the cliches, all the jokes, all things in the game, you know, and the grandpa comes up, but he lost his glasses and now you have to avoid him like the plague. So it's hilarious. And I feel like this is fun. I would tell my friends about it. So I see value in that.
Mm.
But then,
yeah,
how much money are you going to really make from a game like that? How much is it going to scale? But would I advise a small studio to go pursue this? I'm like, heck yeah, it's your first game, go after it. It's cool. Heck, I want to play it. So
yeah. Yep. It was actually a fun game. You mentioned that the market is hyper competitive today. You have thousands of games uploaded every day to the market, to the stores. I mean, we're talking about mobile here. If we have like new studios watching us today or new entrepreneurs that want to get into gaming, what would you advise them to do? Where would you advise them to focus? What would you advise them to focus on? Apart from actually the localized games, which is a smart way to get into the market.
Okay, great question. So I have two answers. One is the VC business hat, the financial answer. And then one is what is my personal answer, the Kareem answer, if you will. See, gaming is an interesting industry because it's very passion driven. Most of the developers, at least what I learned from experience, most of the developers, artists, are actually passionate about the game they're building. So even if Merge 3 puzzle is like the most, it's what's in trend these days, it's the most profitable genre, etc., I wouldn't advise you go do that if you're not passionate about it. Because at the end of the day, gaming is so difficult. What really keeps you going is, hey, I'm building a cool project, I want to see it through. So I feel like that's an important core thing that has to be met. If the founders, if the developers, if the directors are not excited about the project, they're not going to pursue it. So that's like the first thing. Hey, what are you passionate about? And then, within limits, like you have to be hopefully passionate about something that has a road to generating building a business about it. So like you can't be passionate about Flappy Birds and then go build something. So first person shooter, RPG, multiplayer, whatever you want to do, right? So you start there, a specific creative direction, storyline. So I feel like this is an important, we should give some weight, right? Some coefficient to that, right? Because you don't have that, your company will just die, at the first difficulty. So I think that's the first thing, figure out these young entrepreneurs, what drives them, what fuels them. And then you guide them in how to achieve that in the, with the correct business sense. So cool, they're passionate about this type of game. All right, how do you monetize it? How do you build your business case? How do you add all the things around it to turn it into a business? But at its core, they're still passionate about the fundamental, idea of the game.
But where would you draw the line?
In terms of?
I mean, people say never fall in love with your product, never fall in love with your game. If you're passionate about what you do, about your game, where would you draw the line and decide, like, this is not working?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's a bit on the edge.
And this is why I feel another interesting thing in gaming is that having a good team is super important. Because you're going to have always, some people are like the emotional thinkers. Like, they're the dreamers. They're the ones who want to build this crazy game. And then you have other people on the team who complement that skill by being the more rational thinkers. All right, cool. Can we make money from this idea or not? We can't keep blowing runway. So there has to be a lot of, and this is where I said, you have to support these younger entrepreneurs with a common business sense and, good practices in terms of building businesses. So here's your runway, here's your market size, here's our estimated CACO acquisition, like all these boring metrics, just to make sure that whatever they're building has a chance of fruition.
Yeah.
So you're right, and I think that piece is what comes from experience. Mm. That's the thing that we have to import from abroad, right? That's where you get the 15, 20-year-old experience veterans supporting these super passionate younger entrepreneurs. And maybe this circles back, 360, what you mentioned earlier, which is, what's some ideas to spearhead the growth in this region? I feel like there has to be a level of importing experience. I mean, you can either wait 20 years.
There should be a balance between, in terms of experience.
Exactly.
Cool.
So bring in some, that's fine. I mean,
Sure.
That happens all the time.
Sure.
You bring in experts, help them support local ecosystem. One day they graduate, they're able to build things themselves. But do this super fast so you don't have to wait the full period.
Cool. For those who are experienced, not actually for them, it's actually a genuine question. Where do you see us moving as an industry, specifically in mobile, since you operate in mobile? Mm-hmm. We've seen how the market has been acting crazy lately. Where do you see us moving forward as mobile game developers, as studios? in the mobile space?
In the region?
Not necessarily, like in mobile in general.
More general? That's a good question. I was in a think tank room one time with several founders, CEOs of companies, and that was a specific question. Where do you see us in 10 years and in 5 years?
The typical HR question.
Yeah. So I have my thoughts. I can answer the 10-year one first. I feel that the app stores are losing, they won't exist in 10 years.
Mm.
Right? Because the value they bring to the table has diminished to almost nothing. There was a day where I would put my game on the app store,
yep,
and I would get organic traffic, I'll get listed, I'll get users. I mean, that's the value I'm getting. Today, I'm getting none of this.
It's a marketplace today.
It's not even a marketplace. It's like this competitive, it's not, I don't know what it is. It's just a place that you put your app out there. Yeah. And then you're paying 30% of your revenues to Apple and Google. And I'm wondering, okay, great, but what are you actually bringing? Now, I understand they own the hardware at some level, at least in Apple's case. But quickly, a lot of companies, with Epic and whatnot, so a lot of companies are starting to realize we're not getting 30% of our revenue value back from the app stores. So 10 years, I don't think app stores will exist as they were. It might be a little bit more decentralized. I think web very fast is growing.
Again.
Yes.
Definitely.
So I think HTML5 coming in, I think the technology to build nice games on web is going to supersede or be on par with the technology of building a native game, running native code. So when you get there as a developer, I'm like, okay, cool. Why should I even upload my game to the App Store? I can just,
you can bypass the
bypass everything, have a link, if you will, to my game, and then share that link with people.
This is actually powered by cloud gaming.
Oh, cloud gaming is a whole different thing. So when I was at Dell Computers, we worked on architecture. I worked personal architecture for a company back in the day, who was actually building a complete cloud architecture. This was 2010. So from then they were thinking about this. And everything was built out. The problem back then was latency.
Expensive.
And expensive as well.
Yeah, definitely.
So there was a specific problem with running high GPU intensive games, because back then GPU side, or NVIDIA, we weren't able to virtualize gaming sessions. So you can't have multiple games running on one single GPU back then. So because of this limitation, literally every person running a game had like a little GPU running at a data center for them. And we had to build these very interesting architecture of boxes that had over 16 GPUs in them. So it was like just infinity GPUs in them. And anyways, that model didn't work. So the cost issue, but more importantly, that was a solvable problem. It's the latency back then. You had to be literally sitting very close to a data center to stream a game, especially a first-person shooter game where, anything more than 100 milliseconds, I'm not sure what the number is, it's just unacceptable. So I think this will make a comeback for sure. And there was another MBA case about this stuff, but something about technology aside, something about owning a game feels good, right? You bought the game, you have the DVD, it's mine. It's always going back to this premium model.
Yeah, but how would web solve this?
Web won't. So web is very different, yeah. A web is going to be a continuation, I think, of the free-to-play model, all these different things. It's just getting rid of the app store, reducing my funnel, having my own website, my own community. I control everything. I'm not now dependent on these larger stores. Even doing cross-platform becomes easier. I don't have to build a game twice.
Yeah, definitely.
Right? So I just see a lot of advantages from moving to web games than I see for app stores. Now, I don't know what... Obviously, they're thinking about this. The Apple and the Googles, they're thinking about this. I know Huawei has their app gallery as well. So I know they're thinking about this problem. And maybe the first thing we're going to see is a reduction in app store fees. Maybe not. I don't know. But let's see how they fix this. And I hope it's not through regulation. I hope it's not through like blocking websites. I mean, they're kind of doing that, right? They don't allow third-party payments. So I'm interested to see how that
goes. Not for long. Yeah.
So this is where I see the biggest shift happening. And obviously when that shift happens, everyone has to support that. Your engine developers, so Unity, Unreal, they now have to, focus on their web capabilities. So that's my guess for the industry. And yeah, in the next decade for sure.
For the next 5 years?
That's a tough one.
I've played around actually with some cloud gaming prototypes. Mm-hmm. They are essentially mobile games, but they're built like it's like a 150 kilobyte game.
Yeah.
If you install on Android or even iOS.
Yeah.
And then you just play like the normal session. This is why I feel it's much closer than 10 years, at least,
yep.
in my opinion. I've seen this. I've played around with it. It's a link that you just click on and then you start playing.
Yep. I show you the name of the company. It's called OnLive. OnLive, we're one of the first to do this game streaming thing back in the day.
I'm talking about mobile now, not Call of Duty style.
Yeah.
So it's a simple mobile game. Not simple, but like mobile games. Instead of installing, you actually have to install from the stores. It depends. You can install from the store or you can install from a third party like you allow on iOS,
yeah.
And then on Android you can just install it as an APK, but then it's a normal experience.
Interesting.
Yeah. Super interesting.
So we're getting rid of app stores.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I'm glad you mentioned the app store problem.
Yeah, so it's a technology problem, access problem, there's a funnel issue, and there's also user acquisition problem. Because right now for UA, I have to, you know, especially when Apple removed, IDFA,
yeah.
and tracking and all these different things, it's just making it like the value of the Apple store to me is just diminishing. Now, maybe they're, and I have to give that to them, maybe they're doing a level of checking to make sure that the content on the app store is of some minimum level of quality, right? So when I'm downloading a game from the app store, I know it at least works. When now it's like web and you can download anything, it could be a virus, it could be whatnot. So it's an interesting challenge. They do have some value, but I don't think it's 30% of my company's revenue.
Yeah.
Value.
Also, I really doubt that the quality was the issue because, you know, you rarely see a game that is not of quality on the app store,
exactly.
The Apple app store, but it was mostly to drive IAP games in the top charts,
yep.
instead of driving, not IAP, like premium games,
yep.
instead of totally free games. And actually they achieved it today. So.
And that's the thing. So you're right. It was very interesting because you're right. Ease of access microtransactions were very simple on the app store because
yeah.
you have your details in, you just double click, boom. But now the web is doing that.
Yep.
Right. Now you can, whether it's through Apple Pay.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is, again, through Apple.
Ironically.
Ironically. But paying online is now very as simple as a click now. It wasn't in the case back then. You know, you set up your, and I'm sure companies are coming and filling this gap with like fast payment methods and whatnot. And there's a few companies already working on this. So Xola, for example.
Yeah.
Massive web infrastructure for payment systems.
Even like Web3 wallets.
Web3. Yeah, I was trying not to say Web3 on this podcast, but we can talk about Web3. But Web3, I think Web3 is onto something, but way ahead of their time. Like a lot of people have to adopt a lot of different things. But today,
like people, not most people, but like people that are aware of web, that are active in the Web3 space, they actually have wallets on their browser. So if you have a web game, you can
yep.
just
yep.
connect your Web3 wallet and then you bypass, even you don't need Apple Pay for that. Like
yep.
payments are even easier, getting easier on web. Yeah, I think this is one of the important drivers.
Yeah, Web3 is almost solving a different problem, but there's overlap in the
problem yeah.
solving.
Definitely.
So yeah. So you can kind of see where the universe is pushing us. And it's definitely, I feel, away from app stores. So that's my guess. Now, as a CEO of a gaming, mobile gaming company, am I worried? Yes, I'm worried. Because I built my entire knowledge stack. Our IP equity is all in the model, the business model that we have today, which is app stores, downloads,
yeah.
conversion funnels, scalability, cross-promo, all these things. So if that universe switches beneath us, the good news is we're going to be ahead of the curve. But
definitely.
But it's interesting. But are there going to be new entrants to the market?
Yeah, on certain times, the audio is worrying. Since I'm glad you mentioned your worries, what are you guys working on today? And what are your plans for the next like couple of years as Yalla Play?
So Yalla Play, we've been growing for the past 3 years. Month over month, just scaling. So we're continuing. We're kind of in a rinse and repeat cycle right now. We're building out more games that plug into our engine. We've developed technology that allows us to cut development time for the specific genre of games from about a year and a half all the way down to 4 months. So now we're aggressively building out more and more games, scaling out the teams, building more games, launching. And because we're a very we're a portfolio play. Like the company is not hinged on, you know, one successful game. We're just after building as many profitable games as possible. And if one or two, if all of them become major hits, great. We're north of $1 billion valuation. But if none of them become a hit, because the cost per game is so low, then we're still sitting on a very valuable portfolio of games. So that's been our model since the beginning. I've always been the anti-hit business model. And that was even my pitch to VCs, which is, I don't believe in the hit model. I'm not going to dedicate my life to try to getting a hit.
Yeah, I like that.
I try to play darts, and I'd like to get value from hitting the board, right?
Yeah.
And I can throw as many darts as I want, but I don't want my entire life to be based on me hitting the bullseye. So we built a company around that. Now, it did take time to build the architecture and infrastructure that allows us to, you know, rapid deploy and rapid produce. And not only this, autonomously live operate our games, because most of the monetization is from live ops. A lot of meta loops monetization, a lot of data, a lot of statistics, a lot of balancing. So all these systems are now fully built out and automated. So now we're just in factory building mode.
Super interesting.
Yeah, thank you. I think it costs a lot of white hair.
What's one thing that you know today and you didn't know when you started, like 8 years or nine, like whatever, when you started gaming, that you would advise new people starting in the industry to avoid or to do? Maybe it's a positive thing.
Yeah, we had a good story.
Yeah.
I have to talk about your story in a second, but we had a good story, but it was a bit more elongated than it had to be. Like, there's a few things that I've learned that I wish I've known like a year ago, would have done faster. But to ask you a question, and I'm trying not to get too deep on this, right? But there's like two categories of things. There is, you know, classic business gaming advice stuff, right?
Mm.
Things to do, what not to do, technical things, decisions. And those are easy to teach to young entrepreneurs. But then there are the personal stuff, the character building stuff, the things that you learn as a CEO, the challenges, the ups and downs. And I just realized there's no way to teach this to people, because I had the opportunity of mentoring a lot of young entrepreneurs, and I try to talk to them about these things, and it's very difficult for them to understand it. They haven't lived it. Some people call it like the rite of passage, right? You almost have to go through the difficult times to learn. And there's like no other way to...
Learning out of your own pocket.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. And I try to advise entrepreneurs and here, you know, make this decision. It's like, it's almost like hard to teach wisdom, if that makes sense. And I feel that our journey, at least my personal journey as a CEO, 80% of it is this stuff. It's like learning new things about my character, learning new things about how I react to different things, self-organization, my thoughts about all these different things. Like,
yeah.
I'm learning them the hard way, but this is where character development is happening the most. And I feel that now, armed with this, I can go do things at a very accelerated pace than before. But I feel like it makes sense at the end of the day. Like, it can't be
for any,
otherwise we just have...
For any career, you'd be building your character.
Yep.
You know, but for CEOs of gaming companies, I think this is like, it's more of emotional control.
I'll give an example of where I'm trying to go with this. I was watching I can't remember where, but a podcast online. It was, I think, a billionaire out of India. And they were kind of asking him like his story, how he started. And then I didn't watch the whole thing. It was 3 hours long.
Yeah.
But bits and pieces of it. And what I learned from him, one of the core important things that made him successful is he had what he calls an MBA degree at the age of 14.
Yeah.
Right? So he learned a lot of different things from his family, from his surroundings, from kind of the universe he was placed in. And I feel like that's super important. Like, he had to go through these things, and that helped him accelerate. And I feel like that journey in gaming is like super accelerated, because you go through a lot of navigation of difficulties, whether it's like funding or team growing or working like hours, or, you know, Google and Apple changing, pulling the rug up beneath every single time.
Super dynamic.
It's very dynamic. So it's very interesting and a good place to learn. But those are the things that I feel, if you master those and become better at them, then, you know, building out companies becomes a little bit easier. And then the risk of, or like the chance of success becomes higher as well. So I know it's a very classic answer, but I feel like there's a big correlation between, not compared to other industries, but in gaming, because it's like so dynamic, I feel like the correlation between the team skill and the success is very, very high. And I feel because of this, a lot of VCs, the way they pick out companies is by the team, especially seed VCs, mm-hmm. gaming VCs. They really say, hey, show me your team. What have you done before? Right?
Yeah.
I like the team. All right, I trust you. Go build whatever game you guys are thinking about. Team is like the most important thing when it comes to raising seed round in the gaming space.
You know what's interesting about the game space is that it's not enough for you to build a product that that works or that that is functional. Not even a product market fit.
Yep.
It has to be fun. Because you're competing with Facebook, with competing with TikTok, you're competing. It's an entertainment product. I think this is what you mentioned when you talked about the passion with the product. This is the difference between gaming and then other industries. And it makes it a dynamic environment.
Yeah, you're right. I like your analogy when you compare it to the movie industry.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, I mean, the movie industry is a very passion-driven product. But if you get the best actors, you have a higher chance of making more money. I'm not an expert in movies, but I would assume so, right? And it's kind of the same in maybe to a much lesser degree in gaming. Unfortunately, in gaming also, I heard that anecdotally, that's not very, you can't replicate it. So if you get like a super genius game designer and he builds a super amazing game and you get that same designer, tell him, hey, build the next game. It doesn't work. There's no...
Yeah, it depends on the type of game because, you know, hyper-casual was a replicable model.
Yeah.
It was like testing. If the game works, it works. If it doesn't, like we move forward to the next one. So it was technically a replicable model.
But were there teams that were continuously giving a higher chance of success for games? So that speaks to the, you know, the talent.
I think the passion.
Yeah, talent and the passion.
Yeah, definitely.
So what are your thoughts?
I mean, the question was for what's an advice that we can give to early entrepreneurs in the gaming space?
I think the number one advice would be study the market. Find out what you're passionate about. Make sure what you're building is a right fit for what you're going after. Make sure you have like a pre-planned business case before you write the first line of code. So have a plan going in because it's a very rocky sea. Things are going to change all the time. And if you don't have a proper plan going into this, you're going to get completely lost. And then...
A proper skeleton. Because plans,
a proper core, right?
Core, yeah, definitely.
Proper core that's well studied. And I think, you know, the feasibility study checks out. Mm. So you have to kind of approach the game from a passionate angle, but also from a market fit angle. Like, there has to be a market for what you're doing. No. And again, I'm not trying to kill passion or creativity, but... Typically in the gaming space, I feel that very, very, very brand new concepts never done before have a very high chance of failure. But borrowing from an unknown working mechanic and tweaking and adding your sauce on it seems to be a nice recipe, right?
Yeah, so kind of the market works.
Exactly. So there's a lot of kind of advice one could give to younger studios. But again, I feel like if you're starting your career in gaming, want to be in gaming for forever, I think that first game that you work on should be also educational for yourself, right? It's like anybody starting their career.
I want to touch on the advice to entrepreneurs. This is something that I've lately come to understand, or come to actually that came to the surface for myself. I feel that if you're starting anything, not just in gaming, if you're starting something, and when people tell you never fall in love with your idea or with your game or whatever, I think the main idea behind this is it's a numbers game. What I mean is, if you're so attached to your first idea, you wouldn't be able to let it go and launch a second idea. But if you have like 10, 20 ideas, one of them will stick.
Yeah, yeah.
This applies to gaming, applies to user acquisition.
Yeah, fail quickly, basically.
Fail quickly, and the market is huge.
Yeah.
You have a lot of people to cater for. So if you don't find your product market fit here, maybe you'll find it somewhere else. Maybe the market is different. Maybe the product is wrong. So it's about testing the different aspects of your product in different demographies, in different geographies. I'm sure there's always a market for your product. It's up to you to find it. This is something that I didn't know when I started.
Yeah.
It's something that I experienced throughout my career.
Mm-hmm.
I used to be attached to my products. I used to love my games. And whenever you see a bad review on your game, you'd be upset. You start thinking about life, you know. But then if you zoom out a bit, you see that you have 4.5 stars on your game with 20,000 reviews. Okay, that there's one person that didn't like this. But at the end of the day, it's a numbers game.
Yeah.
That's the idea behind this.
That's a very strong advice as well. We had to, pivoting is very important. We've done it before. And also knowing when to kill a game is super important as well. So it's okay to, I like this. So but I wouldn't call this
a numbers game.
No, I mean, there's a lot of there's this cloud of advice that I think you have to kind of follow all the different things. This is one of the powerful ones, as you mentioned. But it's a delicate balance, right? You have to remember that in an organization, at least in my company, I'll speak in my company, we have developers and artists, right? And I have to make sure that they're super excited about this game. Oh, guys love this game, right? And then on the business side, on the analytics side of things, on the financial side of things, is where we're monitoring the market, right? We're focused on the market. Like, your advice is to solo entrepreneurs or small teams, basically.
Yeah.
We focus across all things. Of course, 100%. But when it comes to a slightly larger organization, I feel artists, developers, you have to be 100% passionate. Heck, my job as a manager and CEO of a company is just to make sure everyone's super passionate. And then other different teams, accounting and finance or whatnot, are monitoring the industry, making sure, okay, is there still a market for this game that we started building a year and a half ago? Are the metrics still there? Did market conditions change that make this game unviable based on our earlier plans? And sometimes you just have to your advice, make sure that the leaders are not super married to the game because they have to make the right financial decision. All right, market change, everything's different. User acquisition cost is too expensive. We either try to make this game work and spend another year of development, or we kill it, build a different game. Here's my runway. So yeah, you have a certain amount of oxygen and you're deep underwater. So yeah, you got to choose how to survive.
I think when you say you are data centric, the explanation for a 5-year-old is it's a numbers game. This is how I see it.
So the thing is, it's interesting because your background is in hyper casual.
Yeah.
Right. So you have the option of, you're going to hate me.
Changing.
Yeah, changing. Disposable games, I call it.
Yeah, definitely.
Disposable games. Build a prototype, a game. Each game was built in a couple months, a month, 3 months? A
couple of weeks.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, a couple of weeks.
That 60 games.
I come from a different universe where it's a one-year production cycle. And that's an interesting discussion. Because I'd love to learn, your mindset is probably very it's all about the numbers. Launch this prototype, test it, and I love that. Boom, 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 something hits. In my world, everything is a bit extended. You have to spend at least 6 months to have something that is even decently good enough to get numbers on, right? Fine, let's say 4 or 5 months. But so we do that. But because we know that these games are disposable, then we spend a lot of time in the planning and studying and really making 100% sure that if I throw this dart, it's going to stick somewhere.
On the board.
On the board. So we do a lot of planning. We do a lot of things. Look at our strengths. We try to, we spend a lot of time planning. Our game design documents are 120 pages long, for example. And this is just the main document with hyperlinks to all the data now. So a lot of energy goes into the game just to make sure, everything's done correctly.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned hyper-casual because hyper-casual is a marketing... It's based on marketing.
Yeah.
So it's like a marketing agency.
and marketing agencies, yeah, apart from content creation, they focus on data,
yeah,
on masses, lead generation, user acquisition. Like, if you're marketing a product, you only care about the numbers. And yeah, this is what hyper casual was at the time. Yeah, I'm glad you corrected my perception.
No, it's cool because I noticed we were answering the question from two different lens.
Yeah.
But still, the advice still applies, which is...
Yeah, definitely.
You got to look at the data, right? Even if I spent a year and a half on this game, if it has no feet, I'm going to kill it. Luckily, I mean, we didn't have that except when we were on the website. So when I started building the website, I thought the website was going to be it. And then at some point, I'm like, there is no money here. I had to kill it, raise VC money, and start over almost. By using our same AI and technology. So it was some adoption there. But yeah, that was an example of like realizing, you know, what are we doing? There's merit in the concept, but things need to change to grow.
You mentioned VCs. What advice would you give VCs when it comes to investing in gaming companies?
Yeah. I think there's two points I'd like to add. VCs are experts in, you know, looking at their portfolios, evaluating risks, trying to make the best decisions, calculating, all these different financial aspects of things. But when it comes to gaming, I'm talking about general VCs. When it comes to gaming, I think it needs to be treated a little bit differently than classic and startup investments or like tech plays or SaaS plays or e-commerce plays. Games are their own. They're naturally much higher risk. And VCs spend a lot of time trying to get conviction on the game they're about to invest in. But the truth is, that conviction is probably never going to come. You can look at all the data you want.
Mm-hmm.
You can spend all this time, and all you're doing is there's a lot of opportunity cost for time. At some point, you're just going to have to take the leap of faith. You believe in the team, they demonstrate some traction, go for it. I feel like this is the mindset of gaming. There reaches a point where there's no more stuff you can do. Data, analytics, waiting, looking at competition. There's not much of it. You got to take the leap of faith. And I feel that's the advice I would give for local VCs. Because you look at gaming VCs, they write checks pretty quickly. Look at the team, the game, the market. We like this. Boom. Local VCs are trying to build, spending maybe, I think, a bit too much time, you know, studying.
Traditional analysis. Is more like gaming, more than gaming, right?
Yeah.
Or do you mean like local gaming VCs?
So there are no real fully, I could probably mention one name.
Yeah.
But there are no real fully dedicated local gaming VCs, right? Most of them come from a classic VC model and now are exploring gaming, but they're still applying the mindset of a classic VC investment. So I think that's like number one advice. It's just, you know, that conviction play. And then last but not least, the understanding that the gaming company cycle is very, very different than other models. Like they really have their own monetization models, own exit strategies, own markets. So they're very different. So I think there's a two piece of advice, I would give in that regards. And my recommendation is to invest more in gaming. No, but gaming is very lucrative. It just needs to be looked at from a very different lens.
One more question I have. There's something I'm finding hard to understand. You know, the VC model is usually invest in 10 startups. One would be unicorn, three would be successful. The rest would be, some of them would be average. Why is it not the case in gaming? I mean, if we're considering VCs in the region, I mean, shouldn't you invest like in 10 companies and then expect one unicorn? There's not even 10 investments.
We're very early stage in that regards, right? We're very early stage in that regards. Ticket size also for gaming are a bit higher. That's another thing. Again, I'm not an expert on those, but I believe it's much cheaper to go build out an e-commerce website or a very basic...
Production is cheaper, definitely.
Yeah, SaaS business initially. It's way cheaper than building...
SaaS, it depends on the business because you have to build a product...
Yep.
For a certain period of time before you launch it. So
I guess an MVP. Yeah. Building out an MVP, I think in some classic and software-based companies is a bit cheaper than building out a game. Again, I'm not talking about hyper casual games, but I'm talking about at least, you know, mid-core games, console games. And the reason it's cheaper is because talent as well. Like, you need, you know, with SaaS, software developers, that's pretty much it, founder. With gaming, you need your creative. You need your business. You need your developers. You need, like, you need like at least a 4, 5, 6 person team, just to begin having something that I see like VC investable to go build something out, an MVP that shows some traction. So naturally, I feel like ticket prices would be a bit higher as well.
Also, revenue models in SaaS are more predictable than gaming.
Exactly. So, and this is why the risk appetite in gaming is higher, but the rewards should also be higher as well.
So, yeah, definitely.
And it's interesting because, you know, VCs are in the business of risky investments. And their job is to really de-risk this. Again, it depends on the stage of the investment, you know, series A, B, C, D.
Yeah.
But with gaming, most of the value creation happens in the seed and series A. Some companies go about creating value later on, but generally speaking, they try to come in seed, invest in as many gaming companies, as many teams as possible. They go all build out their games. You know, some of these games should make it. So, yeah, it's slightly different. Again, I'm not a VC. Never worked for a VC, but I can imagine the models that they apply for other investments directly transferred to a gaming company.
Interesting. Karim, it was a really nice conversation. For those people who are watching us from abroad or even in the region that are looking to follow your work, where would they be able to follow your work?
Yep. Thank you very much. I enjoyed the conversation. Thanks for having me. The best place would be honestly LinkedIn. So this is my personal LinkedIn, linkedin.com/KarimSedek, and then our Yalla Play page as well. We post occasional content, some behind the scenes of our studio, some of the things that we do. And yep, I'm very always happy to help local gaming ecosystem entrepreneurs.
Cool. Thanks, Karim.
Thank you very much. Thank you.